This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to these very themes. So normally in each episode, this is the point where I introduce a guest, but things changed. As some of you might have heard, there were some severe storms in several parts of Mexico, causing power outages, and our recording studio, unfortunately, was one of the places affected by that. And this was just as we were preparing to record our last episode. Everyone is safe, repairs are well underway, and those interviews will be recorded very soon. But this incident led us to decide to do something a little bit different today. I'm going to be joined by our producer, Jess, for a mini episode. We will discuss some of our favorite moments from the series and talk about what's to come and share some news about where we might be heading next. Jess has a very different perspective, which I really appreciate. So Jess, I'm going to invite you in and say, do you want to begin?
Yeah, sure. Well, we were just talking before we started recording that I've been on holiday or vacation over the last week. And I sent you a picture whilst I was on the beach that I was actually reading this. It's Technologies of the Human Corpse, which is a delightful beach read. So, you know, I find that, so this is by John Troyer, for anyone that hasn't listened to that episode, and I thoroughly recommend you go back and listen to it. But I end up buying the books of everyone that you speak to.
Good sign.
Yeah. Like, because you want to learn more, you know?
Absolutely.
And I remember during the interview that you did with John, he talked about the preface at the beginning where he does the essay about his sister and her death and things like that, and him saying that some of the poetry some people didn't weren't so into and that. But oh, I found it so powerful.
I felt the same. And I've read all the books of the people who we have on, generally speaking. I certainly read John's book, and I thought it was, you know, I've read many academic books on a variety of subjects, and I loved how John had the courage to puncture that academic wall of knowing that is often part of what you're encouraged to do in an academic book, right? And I really I thought it was very visionary that his editor would encourage him to include that poetry, because it created a whole other dimension to the book. I feel like what could have been a pretty dry, I shouldn't say dry, he's a good writer, but kind of aloof and academic treatment of death really brought in something that's indivisible from our experience of death, which is so personal and so emotionally powerful, right? Like, it's very, very hard to create a barrier between the idea of death and the emotional reality of our experience of death and mourning. And he really beautifully captured that, and also how all of his research, all of his knowledge didn't help him really, you know, like It didn't mean he didn't feel grief, right? He still feels as much grief as anybody else.
Yeah. And it's like the first sentence in the book is, I needed to finish this book before my entire family died. Which is, you know, it's not an overly sentimental kind
not
of type. It's kind of really real. And what I felt, having, you know, as I've mentioned before on the podcast, that I lost my brother, who I was very close to, in our 20s. You don't read so much about sibling loss, you know. You can read memoirs of people or books where people kind of discuss the loss of a parent or a child, which is incredibly tragic, or a partner. But that kind of sibling loss, and also the brother and sister thing, it was so different and interesting to start the book with that kind of story of him losing his sister to cancer, and him going over to Italy to visit her, and the cultural differences in talking about death. And I think I said at the time when we discussed it that this learning from John's work really informed how I kind of interacted with my own dad when he was dying over Christmas time last year. You know, like I asked some of the questions and, you know, I was able to say things really clearly, like, yeah, you know, you are dying, Dad. It's, you know, this rather than skirt around it, you know, I found it really empowering. So I recommend everyone read it.
Did you find that other people were skirting around it when your father was dying? Were you like the only one kind of willing to go? That's so interesting.
I remember going into the hospital. So he kind of was diagnosed and then died within a month of being diagnosed with cancer because it had gone so far. I went in one day and he said, I've decided I'm not going to die. And I was like, have you? Okay. I was like, and he said, yeah, well, you've got to think positive, otherwise you won't get better. And I was like, well, there's thinking positive and there's kind of realism as well, you know? It's like, what can we do to make you comfortable right now? What can we talk about, you know, rather than deny that death is coming, because it clearly is.
That's very brave of you to do that. No, it is. And what was his response like?
Yeah, I think he was kind of like, I think it's possibly the kind of thing only I could have said to him without him having a different reaction to it. But he was like, yeah, okay. And I was able to say things to him like, are you afraid? And he said, yes, I am. You know, and we were able to talk about that and discuss, you know, what might happen after or what might not happen. And I think there's a real power in that, and some of the things that John mentioned really stuck with me, and I hope that other people that are listening, and I know we're kind of hearing it through the listener offerings that come in and things like that, but I'm hoping little bits from each episode are sticking with people.
Yeah, well, I'm so sorry that you went through that, and I'm so gratified and happy that what we're doing here, this project, which is really your idea. So for listeners out there, you know, I had always wanted to do a podcast, but I have no skills in audio. And I was just kind of, you know, I thought maybe someday. And then Jess came to me and approached me and her organization on behalf of her organization, Overcoat. But this was really your baby too. And that's something that really came through in the Caitlin episode. I really loved your conversation with her at the end where she, you know, we were talking about how we all kind of find our place, us weirdos who are drawn to death, find our place in the deathosphere, and what that place is different for everybody. And she pointed out to you, I thought very insightfully, that this was yours, you know, and I really feel like it really is your product. I mean, I'm very happy. I feel like we're obviously collaborators, but this was really your baby too. And on that note, I love reading, you know, each time that we write a Substack, I love reading what you have to say. It's always so thoughtful and well written. No, really, it's great. And it, as I said at the beginning of this episode, I'm so close to this, you know, and I've been in it for so long that I take it for granted in a certain way that you don't yet. And I really, really love seeing it through your eyes. And I'm so pleased that what we're doing here has helped you, and hopefully it's helped other people out there in some maybe subtle ways or not so subtle ways, you know?
Definitely. I think I saw something come through today.
Oh, yeah?
Someone saying, I just wanted to let you know that I'm loving the podcast. Such fascinating, varied, rich series of conversations and connections. Thank you. And I know you've heard people, you know, you've had people drop you a line and things, haven't you?
Absolutely. There's been people in our community that, you know, my students or people in the morbid anatomy community. It comes up in conversation a lot because I do a lot of member events and then I hear from people. And usually it's the most recent episode that strikes them the most. I got a lot of feedback, as I told you about, from Yvonne's episode. People love that. And people really love the conversation with Dylan as well.
What I loved about that is like, you could really hear your connection and your shared experience. And I saw someone commenting that on the Instagram as well, saying that they've been following this journey with you both. So to hear you both kind of talk about it, it was like, wow, you know, it's like really powerful for them.
Yeah. And, you know, Dylan is a fellow traveler. I've known him for so long. Like we were, you know, at the beginning, you know, well, we talk about it in the episode. If you're interested, definitely check it out. But Dylan is the co-creator of Atlas Obscura, but when I met him, we were both just bloggers. You know, I had started the Morbid Anatomy blog. He and his wife, Michelle, who's also incredibly lovely, were doing the Curious Expeditions blog. And we became friends just because we shared the subject matter and interest and this idea of documenting, photographing, and telling stories about these incredible places. Our talk together really also captured the, you know, I think what has become a real essential sub theme of this podcast is creativity. You know, and I think everyone is a creative of some sort, has made something. And hearing about the, you know, the deaths intrinsic to the creative process, the births and deaths, that was really interesting and very true. You know, I've gone through very similar things that Dylan has, and I have a lot of compassion for it. And, you know, looking back, if I hadn't have gone through that, I wouldn't be where I am now. Like there is another side to it. There is, on the other side of the death, there is something new. That has been my experience again and again and again.
And he was so open in that conversation, wasn't he? He really shared that journey, and you can hear how that resonated and that he's not entirely sure what's going to happen next. And I really liked you were able to sort of almost reassure him, like, it will come, give it time, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't feel, as you know, you just went through a physical death of a loved one. Like when you're in it, it doesn't feel possible, you know.
Yeah.
But I think I at least had a voice in my head. I think because I've been tracking these ups and downs for many years through, you know, doing Jungian analysis and things like that, that even though it felt like the end, I knew it was just an end. You know, I knew there'd be something on the other side, but you can't see it yet. And that's that terrifying moment where you have to be in that liminal space between the two, between knowing and unknowing, and have faith based on your lived experience before that there is something on the other side. You just can't see it yet.
Yeah. I often have to remind myself of that it's cyclical, especially if you're kind of like in a point of anxiety about something, or like,
absolutely.
I have to remember that it will pass and then the creative will open up again, you know. Yes. But sometimes in that moment it can feel like we're stuck, you know, like this is it and I don't know if I can cope if it's going to be like this. But actually it does, it continues and that cycle goes round. And
yeah, and I think that's the value of starting to really pay attention to your own cycles, because I think even though you in those moments you feel that way, you know, in your mind from experience, no, I know it feels that way. It always feels that way. But if I hadn't gone through all these other deaths, you know, that's one of the things I tried to do in my recent book, Memento Mori, is help move people through their own recognition of those small deaths they've encountered and lived through their whole life, and what was on the other side that couldn't have come if the death hadn't have come. And I think once you start making that conscious, then even though you feel like you're at sea at that moment, your rational brain can say, okay, I know I feel that way, but I also know from experience, right? Not from faith, not because someone told you, but because in your own life, you've seen it again and again and again. But if you don't recognize it that way, then you can't have that faith.
Completely. And actually that it was your book that, I just dropped another book. There's your book here with all the things on that.
You're so
have.
Organized. Look at that. Beautiful.
But it was that it was your book and doing that, which helped me recognize those sort of cycles. And actually I've started, because sometimes even when you know it or you think you know it, you can forget it in the moment. So I've started trying to journal when I feel that sort of despondent feeling, and then recognize that as part of the cycle. And then when I go into that kind of fertile cycle of ideas and making and creating, think, okay, it will go back to that, you know, it will come.
Yeah.
Because you have a full exercise about that somewhere, don't you? Like
I do. No. Yeah. I mean, I again, because I feel like experientially, we need to have that experience if we're going to learn it. It doesn't help if I tell you that, you know, you have to know it from your own life or it's not useful. Right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I also try to stress when we talk about things like that, that I've found in my own research, so I've done a lot of research about myth and folklore around death, right? And in almost, well, we talked about this in the book, right? In almost, in every culture I've found, death is not the end. right? Except for the scientific materialist model. It's an end. It's an end of one stage of existence and a movement into another. So whether that's true literally or metaphorically, right, there's just something that's archetypally true about that idea that we can tap into, I think.
Totally. And that's what I think Caitlin in the first episode with Caitlin Doherty, she said, like, what are the chances that every other civilization and culture and that have got it wrong, and us as the scientific rationalists, we're the only ones that have got it right? What are the, you know, if you look at it statistically over the entire history of time, what are the chances?
That's what I always thought too, as a history person, like, you know, like there's a hubris to thinking we have it all figured. Every other culture thought they had it all figured out too, right?
Yeah.
I what will time say, what will history say about us if there is a history after us?
Yeah, that's the point. That makes me think of Paul Giamatti's Hellscape. So when you ask him the question, if you could live forever, would you sort of in your current state? And he's like, I want to see what happens. I'm just so curious. I want to wander around that burning hellscape and like see what occurs, you know. But yeah, that makes me think of his slightly dystopian. We've had such a range of guests, you know, when we start kind of talking about them.
It's what comes to mind for you when you think about that? Like, what pops out for you guest wise?
I loved Pam as well, Pam Grossman.
Yeah, tell me more. What did you love?
Yeah, she's great. And so again, it's that creative thing we were talking about. So Magic Maker, The Enchanted Path to Creativity. And she again has kind of exercises or little rituals that you can try within it.
Have you been trying some of the rituals?
Yeah, I've done quite a few different things, like some of the meditations and some of the kind of the, you know, even the really simple things like the magician's pose and the lighting of the candle. I do that every evening, actually. I've kind of created my own little rituals where I kind of light a candle in my little altar space and I'll journal or I'll read, and just having those like small moments of magic, you know, in your own way are really nurturing, you know. It feels like you're doing something for yourself.
I would imagine, especially as a mom who probably doesn't get a lot of time and space to yourself, like to really set that apart as something special.
Definitely. So there's a paragraph in here which says, my friend Susan Abbath is a professor of art history at Bard College, who also happens to be one of the most magical people I know. She once told me this about the spirits. They can't help you if you don't ask. And she encouraged me to request assistance from the unseen world wherever I need it. And that, again, in the Yvonne episode, you know, talking about ancestry and just in general, I think that's a really useful message for all of us. You know, if you don't ask, you can't really receive in general, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like you don't need to be a believer in the spirit world, right? To see the wisdom of humility and saying like, I don't know. And there's something so liberating to saying you don't know and you don't have to know at that moment.
Yeah.
You know, that really, I think, opens up possibility.
Yeah, definitely. That makes me think of Tiffany Hopkins.
Yeah. You're good. You're holding them all in your mind. That's great.
I know. It's because you know, we were saying about the podcast. This is the podcast I want to listen to. I've just got to make the thing that I selfishly want to hear. Well, so I'm your target market.
The heart of creativity, right? And I would argue it's not selfish, because actually, you know, you're doing, by creating this thing, that's exactly how you would want it to be. I mean, that was always my experience with Morbid Anatomy. I didn't try to please anyone but myself. There were all these new blogs and I thought, oh, like, I want to create a blog I would want to read. There were some I did like, and I was certainly inspired by those. And instantly people like me popped up and said, yes, this is a blog. I would argue it's not selfish.
Well, thousands of people all over the world are listening, so they're obviously enjoying it too. Yeah, Tiffany's work really stayed with me too. And the I actually love the meditation she did.
I did too.
It sounds lovely. And I am going to buy the audio version of her book too, which I see she's recorded, because I think that would be a great listen. I will not listen to it when I'm driving.
No, probably not a good idea.
But I watched a documentary about Lily Dale the other day.
Okay.
Do you know, actually, that's a really funny synchronicity. So my husband Adam, he's obviously aware of what we're recording. He doesn't normally listen to things that I make just because we have quite different interests or whatever. He's not into the Radio 4 documentaries necessarily, but he listens to this. He listens to Memento Morbid and he enjoys it. And he said, hey, there's a documentary about Lilydale. I've heard that mentioned in your podcast. Do you want to watch it? I was like, yeah, sure. I'd love to watch it. So we started watching this documentary, which I think was on Now in the UK, the streaming service. And then just as I started watching it, I got an email from Tiffany.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's really funny. And it was the evening here. So I don't normally look at my work emails, but I just happened to pick it up and go onto that. And literally at that moment that we started watching the Lilydale thing, Tiffany emailed. And I thought, I have to reply and tell her what I'm doing right now.
I'm sure she appreciated that.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. I'm pretty sure Tiffany's magic of some kind with all the electric static around her and things like that where we had the recording.
Well, that's another funny thing, right? So twice we recorded her at totally different times and there were issues with the sound and never
different locations and everything. We tried, you know, and she says, you know, it's something that happens a lot, which is fascinating in terms of the way energy conducts and things like that.
Yeah, Paul Kudenars. That was another talk. I don't think I've laughed harder than on any talk than Paul. And it was so cool too, because, you know, Paul is obviously a brilliant storyteller and has an amazing Instagram for people who are interested in following and seeing the kind of images he produces. Mm. But what isn't clear in his finished work or in his Instagram is how hard he works to get a perfect photo. And I really loved hearing about his dedication, not to craft, but he's using craft in service of getting the image that he really wants to communicate with integrity, this object that he loves. And I really, really appreciated hearing about that. And, you know, he seems so funny and jovial, which he is, but it also beneath that is so much intelligence and hard work and dedication. And I really loved how those things intertwined in our talk with Paul and just how funny. It was just such a fun conversation.
He has great comic timing. And
yes, he does.
And I think because of that, you know, his images are so powerful, shocking, I imagine, to a lot of people. So if you go back and look at the Substack for Paul, you'll see we included a lot of the images of the, you know, like the roadkill shrines and things like that. Because he, you know, and he's quite an eccentric looking guy, he's amazing. But actually, through your conversation, you realize the level of seriousness to his work, you know, in terms of like when he was talking about, you know, grinding down the camera lens so he could get that specific reflection or not get the reflection from shooting through the glass and things like that, and how much trial and error there was, and how he would wait for the perfect light and do hundreds of test shots. And it's extraordinary.
Truly. And he, you know, because he presents in such a fun way. It's hidden, I think. You wouldn't expect that with his persona, he was so dedicated and so full of real appreciation and real devotion to the objects themselves, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He really cared about the objects being seen and something to be respected, you know, not just sort of objectified as a curiosity. It reminds me of your chat with Yvonne when you were talking about how some African art, in inverted commas, is actually a devotional object. And then you were saying about how in India as well, you know, and things can fall into this category of art, whereas actually they're bigger than art. They're a devotional, absolutely, spiritual piece, you know?
Yeah. And when I was in India, so I was, for listeners who might not know, I had a honeymoon with my husband, Brian Malilo, in India. Earlier this year, we spent 2.5 months and we were at a temple. I mean, there were so many realizations, but we were at a very ancient temple once. And there were all these incredible sculptural representations of the gods, like 12th century or something like that. Really beautiful, sinuous, incredible, incredible work. And it suddenly hit me that, you know, we only call it art because we're not religious anymore. You know, the creators of those pieces didn't think of themselves as artists the way that we think of it. These objects were seen as containers for the gods. They were functional, you know, and devotional. And I think that's maybe part of why creativity continues to be such an enchanted realm for us, because historically, I think it always has been until, again, this materialistic scientific world that we find ourselves in.
Completely.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Can I ask you about your new book, please?
Oh, you totally can. Thank you.
So Joanna has a book coming out in September.
Late August.
Late August, called The Art of Fairy Tales, which you can pre-order on the Morbid Anatomy website, I've seen. I'm lucky to have a press copy here, and it is gorgeous. So tell me what inspired you to create this beautiful, so it's quite large as well, this kind of coffee table piece.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a funny story. I had previously done a book with that publisher, with Lawrence King in the UK. I love Lawrence King. If folks do not know Lawrence King, go check out their website. They're great. They do beautiful coffee table books devoted to different art. So they had invited me to do a book on anatomical art called Anatomica many years ago, which if you're interested in anatomical art, I highly recommend. And they contacted me because someone had actually pitched this book, this fairy tale book, to them, and for some reason no longer could do it or wanted to do it. I'm not sure. And so they said, this is kind of a long shot, but we've got this project on fairy tales. Would you be interested? They didn't know that when I was in high school, I actually wanted to be a fairy tale book illustrator. I was obsessed with fairy tale art. So I knew quite a lot about, not the history of it, I would say, but the visuals and the artists, and I loved it. So I jumped at that chance and spent many months immersed in the cultural history of fairy tales. And if you peeked at the text, I hope you see, it's super fascinating. It's super underknown. There's so many great stories. So it was such a pleasure not just to immerse myself in those beautiful images, which was, you know, I kept joking my husband, like, it's the most life-affirming project I've ever worked on. Yeah. You know, it's quite different. Usually my visual
very
books
colorful are compared to
colorful and so optimistic, maybe. They definitely, I think these images, I don't know if you feel the same looking at them, Jess, but when I look at them, they feel like artists' attempts to create worlds they wish they could jump into, you know, and leave ours behind. Something aspirational, kind of speculative, something utopian, something better than the world we're in, and allow, you know, a world in which anything can happen. And anyway, the images are amazing and the cultural history is amazing. Right now, it's the women part that I remember really striking me at first. So the role of women, first of all, you know, the term fairy tale was coined by a woman. She was in Louis XIV's court, and she had a crazy fairy tale life story herself. She had been married off to a man when she was a teenager, I think, and he ended up, of course, being a gambler and an alcoholic. And she and her mother were accused of trying to have him killed. And they went to court, but there was not enough evidence to convict them. And then they disappear from the historical record, or she does. She turns up a few years later in Louis XIV's Paris. She starts a salon. And in the salon, she and her fellow women, it was a women's salon, write fairy tales. She called them fairy tales, contes de fées in French. She was the first person to use that term. And she and her friends, her colleagues, her co-writers, on special occasions would dress up as their fairy tale creations. And that really captured my imagination. And to that, we will be doing two launch events. By the time this goes live, you should be able to find out about these on the Morbid Anatomy website. One will be in New York City and one will be in Los Angeles. And the one in New York City, we will be doing a costume ball inspired by this woman, right? I know. Oh, I know.
Wonderful.
I know, because it invites that, right? You want to do that. And I'm co-organizing it with my friend Patricia Yosa, who is a Jungian analyst. And she really thinks of fairy tales as a way that we can indulge in our shadow sides, you know, go to the places of ourselves. And so to create a costume to do that. So you can create a costume of a character you wish existed or some shadow aspect of yourself or your favorite character. And there'll be prizes as well.
Oh, I'm so excited to see the pictures from that. I want to see what you're going to wear.
I haven't even had time to think about that, but yes, so that's going to be a lot of fun.
I think Pam would love that. I know she's in New York.
Yeah, well, Pam will be one of our speakers, actually.
Oh, she will. Oh,
as great. Will Austie. Austie and Pam will both be speakers. So, yeah, if you could stay a little longer in New York, it's going to be the last weekend in September.
I wish I could. That would be an absolute dream.
Yeah.
Something else that I noticed when I'm just kind of looking through the imagery is the, you know, you saying about women being forefront in it, but there's also sort of an equality between children, animals, plants, and grown-ups. Sure. You know, they're kind of all, there's not the same hierarchy as there is in the real world, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, that brings me to another big kind of realization I had doing this research is, and especially going to India really cemented this even more, is, you know, it's not my idea. I've read this, many scholars have said it, you know, this idea that one way of looking at fairy tales is as kind of de-sanctified myth, you know, like myth that no longer is seen as religious, essentially, kind of what happens in the age of rationality to former myths. And I always thought that was a really interesting concept, you know, and people talk about fairies and witches in particular is also being elements of that, right? So like once upon a time, you had these great goddesses that were incredibly powerful. Now we have fairies, and then fairies kind of lose their power over time. And then witches kind of take on the negative aspects of that great goddess, you might argue. But when I was in India and I was hearing the myths of the gods that are still very much alive there and honored and believed, I think, on some level, you realize how similar they really are to fairy tales, right? These are spaces where magical things happen. We would call them miracles in the Christian religion, right? Mm-hmm. But these are like thinking about different story forms that allow for the non-rational to penetrate, right? And I think horror is one of them. And that's something we've kind of skirted around in some episodes. I think talking about sinners with Yvonne.
Yeah.
Horror. And I wonder if that's part of why horror is such an attractive story form right now, because it is, along with fantasy, maybe.
I mean, fantasy is having a huge resurgence, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's also directly related to fairy tales, but these story forms that allow us to include things that are mysterious that we don't have to explain one way or the other. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's an ambiguity in so many horror movies that deal with the supernatural, I feel like.
Mm. And that, you know, that's made me think actually, because there's the rise in what they would call fairy smut, you know, the kind of like sexy fairy novels, the stories and things like that.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. So lots of people, lots of women are really into that and are reading and writing stories about it. So there's obviously some sort of sexual freedom within the fairy tale world that is appealing as an adult, and people are sort of using it to rewrite because maybe that's a safe space to do it, you know?
Totally. That's really intriguing. I didn't know about that. Well, and then the original fairies, before they become kind of the fairies we think of today, had a sexual element, right? They could seduce you and take you out of your world. If you've ever read Christina Rossetti's Goblin Market, there's a few illustrations from it in there where, if you haven't read it, listener, go out and read it. It's a beautiful poem and it's got a lot of sexual subtext. But the fairies were earthy and not Christian, right? It's really Christian religion that starts to demonize sexuality.
Yeah. God, that's literally fascinating, isn't it? Yeah, literally demonizing. Yeah, they took the king of the forest and made the devil, didn't they? So that people have familiar imagery. And I learned that in Waking of the Witch from Pam.
Well, on that note, there's a woman I would love to invite into a future episode. Her name is Sharon Coggan, Coggan. I've got her book right here. She wrote a book about the transformation of the god Pan into the devil. And it's a long study. Yes. From a Jungian perspective, it's brilliant and illuminates so much.
Oh, yeah. I'd be interested in that.
Definitely. Yeah. She's game. She's game. She's awesome.
Excellent. Well, season two. Here we come.
There you go. Season two.
Oh, thank you, Jana. That's been really good to sort of catch up over the episodes so far. And who did I think of? Just Jeffrey Kripal as well, that episode when you were saying just now about the you know, giving yourself permission to, you know.
Well, I think Jeffrey Kripal's a great one to bring up because I think his superhumanities are about that too. You know, and his earlier books really focus, the ones that I'm familiar with anyway, some of them focus on not fairy tales, but rather comic books as being a place that also allow this kind of, he would say, paranormal or superhuman kind of unexplainable stuff to be brought in and in this very powerful form, in that they're both visuals and text. You know, he's really interested in that.
Yvonne's going to write that book, isn't she? She said, well, she's writing it at the moment about voodoo in comic books and things like that and how the portrayal of it. Yeah.
And that makes me think also of Lee Unkrich with his Coco, which I would say Pixar's and, you know, these kind of animated films are another place where we can bring in the unexplained, right? Like I think it's not a spoiler to say that the main character travels to the underworld and, you know, visits his ancestors in the land of the dead in a way that really only animation can capture, you know, like how would you do that?
It could only have been done in the way that they have. Through animation, it was made for that medium. Just talking through it, there's so many, you know, and there's ones we haven't even mentioned that were amazing too. So there's
Osties was amazing because it came up. We were talking about the conference, and Caitlin was amazing. Every single one.
Shannon Taggart as
Shannon
well.
Shannon also amazing. Yeah,
Oliver Backman too, and Leela Taylor as well. Great one with. I mean, we got a lot of good feedback about Leela's episode, and the, you know, we could see that people were really interested in the horror of buildings and stone tape and all the fascinating things I'd never considered.
Totally. I also really love her focus on the African-American experience in the Gothic, where when she talks about it, it's so obvious. You know, you almost can't even. And she's so articulate and amazing. Yeah. And, you know, what is wonderful about all of this is these are all people in the morbid and enemy community. You know, this is the constellation of amazing people that we have revolving around this organization that are, like yourself, right? Finding their places in the deathosphere, creating their own contributions, their own creative projects, dealing with their fascinations that then speak to all of us as well.
And it's such a warm and generous space, I feel, you know, through all the
people. And on that note, what that makes me think of is the generativity of death, right? And we can say that our audio engineer also has one of these. We bought him a gift before you left, right, Jessica? He loved it so much. And she sat with us in all of our early episodes.
Yeah, she did, So describe her for anyone listening.
So let's put her in the Substack as well.
Yeah.
So if you've not heard of Santa Muerte, we should have an episode on Santa Muerte.
Yeah, I'd love that.
We should interview Eva Arides. Mm. Let's do that. Santa Muerte is a folk saint in Mexico that takes the form of a female Grim Reaper, and she's hugely popular. And she, if you go to religious shops anywhere in Mexico, you'll find representations of her. You might even, if you live in the United States, I've seen them in London even. They're around. She's moving around the world. But this particular statue that Jess and I both have is one of my favorites because she's portrayed as heavily pregnant. She's wearing a red gown with a low cut red gown with like silver trim. Mm. And she's pregnant, which to me speaks, I think is the kind of one of the metaphors for this show, right? The generativity of death, of thinking about death, of relating to death, and the seemingly paradoxical fact that engenders so much new things, new creativity, new work. And if we go back to the ancient myths, right, the underworld is a place of death and the ancestors and where the new crops come from. So is this sense in the natural world that we actually really see that. And we know, of course, it's the death of organisms that creates the fertility of the soil, right?
We could keep talking forever.
I know. And we will.
We will. Oh, thank you, Joanna.
Thank you. And thank you, Jess, for coming to me. We met when I was in London, and that was a while ago. We were just starting to talk about it. So I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago or something like that. So this is really, if Jess had not come and tapped me on the shoulder, this wouldn't be happening. So thank you, Jess. I'm really enjoying this.
Oh, well, it's my dream come true, as you know. And I love it. Thank you, Joanna.
You're welcome. Thank you. So one thing we would really love to say to all of our listeners is just this. Thank you. We have been genuinely overwhelmed by the response to Memento Morbid thus far. People have been incredibly generous with their messages, their reviews, their recommendations, and their contributions. It has been incredibly moving to see this community grow. What makes it even more remarkable is that we've done this almost entirely through word of mouth. We don't have a big marketing budget, and every single person who has shared an episode with a friend, posted about it online, or even left a rating or review has helped us reach new listeners. We would love to keep making Memento Morbid for a long time to come. As an independent podcast, that means continuing to grow our audience. Once we're consistently reaching a certain number of listeners, it becomes much easier for us to attract sponsors who can help us cover the costs of making each episode. So if you have been enjoying Memento Morbid, the biggest favor you could do is simply tell someone about it. Share an episode with a friend who you think might appreciate it, recommend us on social media, or leave us a rating or review wherever you listen. It might seem like a small thing, but it really does make a huge difference. And we'd also like to share an enormous thank you to everyone who has purchased something from our merchandise collection. Every purchase helps support the production of this podcast. And if you have photos wearing or using anything you purchased, be sure to tag Morbid Anatomy so that we can thank you. We have also just launched a Buy Me a Coffee page. If you are interested in supporting the podcast directly while we continue to grow, you can make a small donation there as well. And you'll find that at buymeacoffee.com/Memento Morbid Podcast. However you choose to support us, whether it's by listening, sharing, leaving a review, buying some merch, or even making a donation, we are incredibly grateful. Thank you so much for supporting our efforts to make thoughtful, nuanced, and hopefully very useful conversations about death, life, and the in-between freely available to all of those who might be interested.
I have to tell you, my eldest son, Joey, the 12-year-old, he spent his pocket money on some merch. He's bought a navy t-shirt with the small logo on, and he bought like a little bag that you can get with it. So he was wandering around Pembrokeshire wearing his
I love it. That's really sweet. Thank you so much for joining us for today's mini episode. We'll be back very soon with new conversations featuring Evan Michelson and Lilith Dorsey, and we cannot wait to share those with you. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and everything that we do, visit morbidanatomy.org. You can also follow us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, or TikTok, and join us on Substack at mementomorbid.substack.com. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.